Okay, everyone. Hello, everyone. I am Kay Thompson, and we are the News, Information, Education, and Global Communications.
Blog Talk Radio.
And good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Kay and Gus Show. I am Kay Thompson, and we are here on GoPro Radio Networks, and we're on the Internet. We are the News, Information, Education, and Global Communications Internet station. We do true news. I'm Kay Thompson, and how do we do this? Through constant research, confirming information from our global communications recipients and constituents, and our constant contact with news sources. And we write to you, and wherever you are, we want to know more about you and you about us, and we will put your information on the air and bring you top controversial stories. We are going to be dealing with a hot-button story from years ago with several guests on our political roundtable segment. We are starting that earlier, and we're going to be having it on a little while longer. One of the main reporters and producers that worked that case, meaning that I don't even know if I mentioned that the Central Park rape case some years ago. Her name is Anna Sims Phillips. Anna Sims Phillips. She was a producer and broadcaster on CBS, and then Anna went to ABC, where she was producer and senior producer. Just got finished doing the, just retired, right, Anna? Are you there, Anna?
I'm here.
How are you?
I am fine, thank you.
I'm so glad to be here.
Yes, I am retired after 35 years.
Yes, 35 years. Your last was in Haiti, right?
My last what?
You produced the programs from Haiti for ABC?
No.
No? Okay.
My last story was living in prison with juveniles.
Oh, okay.
In Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
So I lived an entire summer in prison with juvenile offenders.
I didn't know about that, Anna.
Yeah.
Because I know that you have so many fantastically interesting stories under your belt. And I didn't know.
I'm so invasive. I literally lived in a prison demonstrating a project called the Missouri Project. Okay. And it's rehabilitating juveniles instead of, treating them like prisoners. It's redirecting their lives in more productive ways.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to have some successes or what?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Were you able to have some successes?
Yes, it actually is being adopted by many prisons. Some of them court ordered, like Louisiana. The state of Louisiana was court ordered to go and learn how the Missouri Project works. Texas as well. And instead of being so punitive, they really teach kids how to redirect their lives. They give them another chance.
Yeah.
They give them a lot of chances, but mostly they teach them how to live.
I see. Now, when you did these stories, sometimes you were gone for about a year or so, building up.
Almost every time I'm gone about a year. Mm-hmm. I lived or more in Camden. I lived in Camden for 18 years instead of saying. I reported in 2005 about Camden. Mm-hmm. Camden, New Jersey had the distinction of being the most dangerous city in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And that same year, they also had the distinction of being the poorest city in the United States. And they lived 10 minutes away from a town called Moorestown that was designated the best city in the world to live.
Wow.
Just 10 minutes down the road.
Yeah.
And instead of saying, which could have been very easy for us to say, well, here's the drugs and here's the crime. Instead, we followed three children. And children don't know that they live differently from anybody else. They have the same dreams and aspirations that anyone else has.
Yeah.
And so we looked at Camden through their eyes.
Wow. That sounds absolutely fascinating. I want you to come on another time and talk about that, at length. There are a couple of other stories that that I want to talk to you about at length. But right now, I want to get to the Central Park Wilding case. And I'm saying Wilding because we both know where that came from. You know, that full-page ad that was in, I think, I don't know if it was the Times or the Daily News or what. Do you remember?
Yes, it was a. It was one of the tabs. And I think it was either the Daily News or the Post, or maybe both,
yeah,
actually, because it was a term that was coined right there, you know, through, I think, one of the detectives.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't cover the original 1989 trial. I was just coming off of another explosive story.
Which one was that?
I was Tawana Brawley.
Ah, yeah.
And I was just finishing up Tawana Brawley. And so I didn't do the Jocker case. I think what I did after that is I went over to Street Stories. So I was, you know, I moved over to the network.
Mm-hmm.
So I watched that story. I didn't come up against that story until one of my colleagues at ABC Primetime saw a 3-inch column, just barely 2 paragraphs, about a confession, about a prisoner that confessed to being the actual rapist in the Central Park jogger case. 3-inch column, New York Times. Can you imagine that? Mm-hmm. Buried somewhere in that newspaper.
In the New York Times?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
3 inches. Mm-hmm. And she got the name and sent him a letter and became and began a correspondence with him. He wasn't...
Was this the person who eventually confessed?
Yes, Mateus Reyes was the... Not only did he confess, he it was his DNA.
Mm-hmm.
It was found. Remember, in the original trial, even though 5 kids confessed,
yeah,
there was no, absolutely no physical evidence linking them to that crime.
Mm-hmm.
So she... continued a correspondence with him, and it was, and I was assigned to go up to the prison with her and talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
The first time we showed up there, he refused to see us. And I said, okay. And we came back every day, mm-hmm, every day until he saw us. And then I think it took all summer. If we began this in May, we didn't do an interview with him until September.
Wow. Was this because
of... So this was a long process.
Unwillingness or what?
Apprehension, unwillingness. Then because he wasn't... Something happens. You know, you don't get any visitors. He didn't get any visitors. His family's in Puerto Rico. So if someone's coming to visit you every day, you get out of your cell, you get food, you talk, you develop a relationship. I think at the end, he fully intended to do the interview. He wanted to purge. But I think he knew that after the interview was done, the visiting would stop. And so there was a little bit of that. There was apprehension. There was, of course, question on our part. I still have the map that he drew me. He knew the details. He was very in touch with the details. He could draw a map from where he entered the park, from when he spotted her the first time, what she had on, what he did to overpower her, and where he raped her, ravine.
Was he stalking her?
No, he actually was, you know, he was looking for another victim. And he stalked her in terms of having selected her. He was attracted to her spandex pants, he said. And she had a Walkman on. And she wasn't running particularly fast.
Mm.
And she was completely unaware of her surroundings. She was listening to music and running.
Mm-hmm.
And she wasn't running fast. So, and he was looking around for something. He said he picked up a huge tree limb, hit her with it. When she fell, and he hit her with rocks, he raped her, took a Walkman, actually, and walked out of the park with her Walkman and blood in the front of her pants, his pants, and he encountered a plainclothes cop that asked him if there was any commotion going on in the park. He said no and continued to walk out of the park.
And the policeman didn't apprehend him or go further?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, rather.
Didn't even notice. It was probably dusk, maybe even dark by that time. But he managed to walk out of the park, Walkman, blood on his pants, and a conversation with a plainclothes police officer.
What happened after that?
Well, after that, he committed.
This morning, what you know, all hell broke loose.
Well, yeah. After that, there was... they apprehended five boys, all of them living in the Schomburg on 110th Central Park North, right at the mouth of the entrance of the Central Park on 110th Street. And they got taped confessions after a day or two, prosecuted them, and they went to jail and served their entire time. Corey Weiss served over 13 years. As a matter of fact, he was the first one that I would interview.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But how is it that the policemen, how did they get these concessions? You know, I remember that, you know, being on an LIB at that time, you know, and
Well, all of those things would be according to accounts, journalistic accounts, because I didn't cover that story. I watched it and read about it daily, you know, but I certainly didn't have any inside information. But they taped it. They moved the kids from the – they wore them down, actually. They – didn't allow two of them to see their parents. The other parents were ignorant to the law. And then the press did what we sometimes do, and that is, you have to remember 1989, what New York City was like. There were cases, there were several cases that went along in New York, and until the Howard Beach trial, where they assigned a special prosecutor, Charlie Hines, to the case, and he got convictions in Howard Beach case, that was the first case in New York City where there was actual convictions of a crime committed against black people. And then there was the Tawana Brawley story with no resolution at all. And a lathering up of the citizenry. And then the next, the Jarga case would be a white, Wellesley, Yale graduated stockbroker jogging in Central Park, and five black male youths wilding in the park. And that case certainly lathered up the citizenry. You've got a mayor coming out. It's a mayoral election that year. There's a combination of so many things that were happening at the time that made the moon and the stars align themselves.
All right.
There was a push for a conviction. There was just a push for a conviction.
We had lost you for a moment, by the way.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm actually on a hard line.
Yeah. Okay, I think it was us here. But so what happened, take us back to after he confessed, and the policeman saw him, and, you know, everything hit the papers the next day, and how did...
Well, there's some interesting things now. I'm going to tell you there was... a rash of rapes in that upper West Side area, in that kind of East Harlem, because the park on its east side is on Fifth Avenue, so it straddles Spanish Harlem.
Mm-hmm.
And on its west side, it straddles the Upper West Side. So there was a rash of rapes in the Upper East Side area, the part of the park that's on 110th and 5th, so 112th, 113th, 5th, Madison, in Spanish Harlem, for all intents and purposes.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, the same detective and one of the ADAs, one of the assistant district attorneys, worked on both cases. Mike Sheehan and the ADA worked on Central Park Jarga,
mm-hmm.
and they also worked on the Mateus Reyes case.
Wow.
Mateus Reyes would be the first case where there's use of DNA in New York City.
Wow. Mm.
And there's a new mandate at the NYPD called CopStats, and it was a new way of policing. Huh. In other words, it's the policing that is still being used where you track crime,
mm-hmm.
and in order to you track crime in hopes of preventing these same repeated crimes in a certain area.
Anna, listen,
and one of the things...
Anna, can you
I'm
hear
sorry? Me?
Listen, we
yes,
have
I can.
To take a break around right now, okay? Stay with us. We'll be right back, okay?
Okay.
All right? Stay with us. We'll be right back, everyone. Dr. K. Thompson and Mr. Kane Gus Show. Stay with us.
Deshaun. Steve Corky.
Occupy the planet Earth. I testify, there's a piece of work. I'm gratified, down to the dirt, been around the world a few times. I've seen the hurt, great hurricanes and tornadoes. Morning time, demand design. Under that concrete, y'all call the street. It's a heart of land, you can hear the beat. The pain is on the line, and the pain is on the line. The pain of losing home, yeah, with the pain of the unknown.
Everyone, I have to apologize to you, Anna, and I have to apologize to our audience. We had a period we just went completely black for a minute or so. And so we were involved with this story, which is absolutely fascinating. I'm Kay Thompson, and this is the Kay and Gus Show. As you know, Gus Henningberg, my partner, passed away about a month ago, and we have been more or less recovering from that and doing our shows and doing the tributes and this kind of thing. But we are back on track. And with more energy than ever, and I'm talking to one of my favorite people, my good friend Anderson Phillips. He was one of the producers over at CBS. Very important producer. I mean, when she did a story, it would take about a year or a little more. I know about your travels, Anna. There's so many fascinating things. We have people running around here, you know, saying, tell us that story. Let's hear it. You know, let's hear the rest of it. But anyway, let's go back to the new cops. What was that? the new cop.
It was a new, when Bill Bratton arrived as police commissioner, he promoted a guy named Jack Maple to become his chief strategist. And he's the one that became famous for CompStat, and that's a system of mapping crimes with a computer. So, in other words, he pushed the cops to question suspects for leads on any and all other crimes. So that if Mike Sheehan were doing his job the way that Maples intended him to, he would have, when he arrested Mateus Reyes, maybe found out his association with the Central Park Jogger case, or maybe not. But surely the DNA is sitting around, and it's not matching any of the five suspects.
But still,
there was no zero physical evidence.
Wow.
Zero. And there's semen on the woman's sock, on the victim's socks, that matches none of them. And Mateus Reyes' DNA, as a matter of fact, he has a distinction of being one of the first people, one of the first cases that used DNA.
So,
and it isn't until 13 years later that he confesses to this crime. And the Daily News spent three-inch column article.
Mm.
You know, just put your fingers up in 3 inches. So that's 2.5 paragraphs, print-wise.
Yeah.
Buried in the paper somewhere.
Mm. So the cops just railroaded these kids, in other words.
It appears so.
And they went to jail, and there was this big, you know, everybody was upset, you know. Because
they served their time, too.
Yeah, and they served their time. And now they have...
And they did something interesting. They maintained their innocence.
Yes. But why is it that they were saying at some particular point, we heard that they had confessed? What was that all about?
Well, I suspect that Ken Burns probably deals with that more than I did. The focus of my story was more that someone has confessed to a crime, and a crime that garnered so much attention for almost a year and a half. And prosecutor Nancy Ryan in Morgenthau's office was investigating it.
Mm.
And while they were investigating it, we were in conflict because I was about to do an interview, and they weren't finished investigating it.
Mm.
So. It became a conflict between us, ABC News at that time, primetime, and Morgenthau's office. And at that point, Linda Fairstein is the one that prosecuted that case. She was famous and known in New York for a sex crime unit, and having successful convictions of sex crime cases.
Yeah.
And this would be one of her biggest cases.
No one can understand, with the lack of evidence with these kids, how this happened. So did the police persons actually know, were they aware of the evidence that didn't exist? It sounds as if they were just waiting for something to get these kids on because they were were they in the park at all?
Yes, they were in the park. It's questionable whether they... did or whether they were running. Apparently, there were 30 kids in the park.
Uh-huh.
There were victims of crime, you know, that kind of mob kind of crime. Like a guy got hit in the head with a pipe. Two gentlemen were riding a tandem bike and they got pushed off. Things like that. The kind of crime that's associated with a mob, you know, kids running through the park.
Mm-hmm.
But it wouldn't be until later that someone would discover and hear someone moaning in the ravine. And this is after several crimes had already been reported to the police in the park.
That next day?
Of various victims.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, the worst of it would be the woman, the Central Park jogger lady.
Mm-hmm.
So it was this happens more frequently than it should. It's a combination of the police's diligence and desire to wrap up a case.
Uh-huh.
A city who's has a history of having racial tension,
yes.
Especially a recent history, having cases back to back that have to do with crimes and race.
We have a poll.
The presumption of innocence thrown out the window, huh?
We're going to be joined by a caller. So just stay where you are. You're on the air.
Okay.
You're on the air. Who's it? Oh, hello?
Hello?
Yes, you're on.
Hi, this is Eric Payne calling in. I'm just listening to the conversation.
Eric?
Hello to Anna Phillips.
Anna? Hi, Eric.
Yeah.
How are you?
Pretty good.
But please,
good
please
to hear
continue.
You.
I don't want to interrupt. This is a very remarkable that you're sharing with everybody. So please continue.
Well, there's something that happens in these cases sometimes, and it's an unholy alliance that's formed. There's the citizens of New York that want a conviction. The police that need to tie it up quickly and wrap it in a nice bow and deliver convictions. And the presumption of innocence is thrown out the window sometimes when the press gets involved because they cover the negative part of it. And this is the press not doing their job. This is a case of the press not doing their job. And following lockstep with the feelings of the citizenry and the courts pushing forward and the jurors. Now, this is a case that lasted pretty long.
Mm-hmm.
It was explosive sometimes. And the jury really sat in there 10 to 12 days. Now, sometimes the jury will cut corners because they feel by the seventh day a juror's in there, they feel like they're hostage. And they'll do anything to get out.
Any of us that have done jury duty certainly agree with that.
I covered a story once where the jurors could not for the life of me explain the case. I've had jurors tell me, because you can finally talk to the jurors, especially you're doing a case that you're rehashing the case. And they'll say, he and his friends were laughing. They just looked guilty.
Oh, boy. Hmm.
So cases are, I always said to myself that I would plead out before I'd put my life in 12 people's hands.
Wow.
Wow.
It's frightening.
If I can, I just would like to, and maybe you guys answered this question already, but is it true that the actual perpetrator of the crime was years later, it came out that there was a gentleman that actually did do this crime and the kids were exonerated, right?
Yeah, their convictions were vacated. Morgenthau vacated the convictions. And the gentleman that actually did the crime was very eloquent in explaining how he committed it. The details were consistent with the evidence found in the original case. His knowledge of everything that went on was consistent with that which happened. Once again, the physical evidence. This the young lady that the jogger, Ms. Neal, she didn't recall a thing. So she had no knowledge or recollection of what happened to her. But something interesting happened, too. We did the story, and, of course, it opened up the case, and it opened it up to the public and the other media. Dateline, then shortly after that, the Central Park jogger wrote a book, and Dateline got the first interview with her. So they did an hour on her book and the interview. For the first 25 minutes, this is after the convictions were vacated, and those five gentlemen were considered innocent. Dateline did a story for the first 25 minutes rehashing the case and still calling the kids, the Central Park jogger kids, the person that was the kids that were convicted, the Wilding kids. They did all of that, and then they go to her interview. Maybe they included two sentences that said, since then, their convictions have been vacated and somebody else has confessed to the crime. And this is Ms. Neal, who was the victim of this crime. This will be your first time meeting her.
By the way,
but for the first 25 minutes, they went on as if this entire act.
Okay. We are being joined with another caller. Just jump right in with the other caller. We don't want to go for a break right now. No break. Let's get the other caller on the line also. Okay. All right. Anna, continue, please.
That it was astounding to me, that months after we did the story and months after Morgenthau vacated those convictions and it was widely known that these five gentlemen did not do this crime, that Dateline did a story and opened the entire story, rehashing the case without saying not once that this isn't really what happened.
No.
So it's the impression one is left that they still are tainted by that by a crime that they didn't commit, and they continue to be tainted.
Of course.
Did any of these guys bring any type of lawsuit against the city of New York?
Yeah, there's an active attempt to... all five of them have sued the city for $50 million. So they all have attorneys. And, I mean, this has happened in 2005. So imagine that right now they've just attempted to subpoena Ken Burns for their interviews and stuff because the city's defending themselves against that lawsuit.
Now, Ken Burns is a writer and a...
documentary filmmaker.
Yeah, documentary filmmaker. Yeah.
Yeah, who's done quite a bit of documentaries on this country, from the Civil War to baseball,
right,
to jazz.
To jazz. Jazz music, where he included the real history of Black America. He did a very good job, in my personal estimation.
Yeah, he's just doing the Dust Bowl. And this is a departure for him. This is a departure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go ahead.
But he feels so strongly that these kids continue to be, prosecuted and continue to be the people that you know they say committed this crime. They're not celebrated as these young fellows. I mean, and they've given 20 years of their life. These kids are no longer kids. They're almost 40 years old.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They were almost 40 years old. And I had a hard time reporting this case. This was an uphill battle for me because I was a person associated with the Tawana Brawley story.
Yes.
I was on the wrong side of the Tawana Brawley story, the parents would say. And so I understood them and their disdain for the media. They'd been railroaded so badly by anyone that ever touched this case that they were none too happy to see me.
Mm.
But I Johnny Cochran them. I said, if I can get... They wouldn't participate in my story, even though I told them that I had the person, the confession, and I would be doing the interview that would finally free their children.
Yeah.
And they didn't want anything to do with me. They didn't care. They weren't believing in media, and I didn't blame them. But I said to myself, all I need is one. All I need is one parent. All I need is one. And it was Corey Wise, his mother, Dee Dee. And we drove up there. We drove up to, I want to say he was in Dannemora. But I had to go between Dannemora and Audubon. So I have a persistent memory that it was Dannemora. And we drove up to Audubon where Corey still was in jail after 13 years.
Wow.
After his sentence, he was still up there. I drove up there 6 hours. I walked into prison. I said, Corey, I am going to ask you to request a jailhouse interview. It's the only way I can interview you in jail, and I will be back here. And I promise you that you're going to leave this jail when I finish.
Mm.
And I said, but you got to trust me. And he looked at me. He said, okay. He asked for a jailhouse interview. They immediately called me a jail. They weren't going to allow this jailhouse interview because they said to me, we are releasing him. And I said, can you let me know when you're releasing him? Or can I do it if it's in the foreseeable future? Then I want to do this jailhouse interview fairly soon. And they told me that they weren't going to let me know when they're going to release him. I said, okay, I'll be standing outside the door until you do. I'll be out here every day.
Wow.
Until you do. And 2 days later, Corey Wise walked out of that prison with me and his mom.
Wow.
Yes. Two days later.
Wow. Whew. That's scary. That's scary. And it's so good to hear that he is out now and he's so good to... Well, they're suing.
Mm-hmm.
I hope they get everything that they...
And that would make the parents, and then, of course, the parents still weren't going to talk to me. So I said, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
Dolores Weiss will talk to me.
Yeah.
You're going to be represented by one parent. And then they all decided that they would all speak. And that's how I managed to get those interviews.
I'll get one of them or a couple of them on the show so we can, you know, give their side of their feelings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what they went through, because it was horrible. I remember being at times, and I also remember quite well the Tawana Brawley story, because that was when Sonny Carson, was on the air, and Denise Johnson was the engineer. Eric, you may remember this, and Denise asked me to come into the control room because of the fact that Sonny was on the phone and wanted to talk to me. And I got into, said, going for a break, everyone. Hey, Thompson, WLIB, stay with us. Went into the cold control room, and lo and behold, I said, Sonny, haven't seen your face for a long time. He said, Kay, he said, this young girl has been raped by, has been raped, we think, by 6 white cops up here in Wappinger Falls. And my comment was, Wappinger, where? I didn't have to put, your authority put that on the air. I remember being outraged when I heard it. And so, you and I, you have been through some things and, and guided
me. And quite frankly, no one would know about Tawana Brawley if they weren't watching Channel 2.
Yeah.
We were the only ones that interviewed her.
That's right. That's right.
No one ever had an interview with Tawana Brawley except us.
That's right. And after you
So Sonny Carson or no one would know about her. And quite frankly, we shouldn't have. She was a 15-year-old child,
right,
protected, and a rape victim, an alleged rape victim, protected by anonymity. It was her aunt that called us and told us to interview her, gave us permission to interview her. And so that would begin from that interview.
Yeah.
That Mary Murphy did from Channel 2 News on a Sunday after Thanksgiving. So it was a quiet, slow news day. It was a Saturday before Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm. Boy,
quiet, slow news day.
Yeah. How well I remember those days. What feelings of outrage again and again and again and again. with things happening in the community.
Our friendship was surely challenged.
Yeah.
We were, and this is how strong our friendship is.
Yeah.
Little did they know that we were the best of friends.
Mm-hmm.
And they would come in and talk about me and try to get me fired. and you would remind them that I was your friend. And finally, we just let them go ahead.
Yeah.
We were going to be fine. We would get through this.
Yeah. Boy, I'm telling you, it was really, really something those days. And there's so much more to talk to you about. No doubt about it. So you're going to be coming on again, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I'd be delighted to.
All right. There's so many different stories that you... Listen, didn't you do... Wait a minute. The last story, or the last... I'm not saying the last involvement, but you had a group of grandmothers that you did a story on 2020 about. And they,
I surely did. And that group of grandmothers was really my support group. Because I'm a grandmother raising my grandchildren. Those women saved my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we go and we think that your life can change on the head of a pin. And one day I was a journalist and my son was in his 30s. And for the first time in my life, I was pursuing my life. I was by myself, and the next day I went to court, and I was the new mom of a 2-year-old.
Yeah.
And a woman, I had a knot in my throat the entire time. I hadn't cried, hadn't done anything, and I was taking my grandson to Children's Specialized Hospital, and a woman, and all the police officer did was say, you have to go to register him. You have to go down this hallway, take an elevator. Racking sobs. I was crying my heart out. It was the first time I cried. And it was a voice that was standing behind me. She says, I know how to get there. I'll take you there.
Okay.
And I was wiping snot and tears. And she said, I said, I'm a grandma and I'm raising this, my grandson. And I looked at her, and she looked as old as I did. And I said, is that your kid? She said, no, I'm a grandma, and I'm raising 10 of my grandchildren.
What was her name?
I wiped my, huh?
What was her name?
Her name was Edwina Haig.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I was waiting for you to say that.
And I wiped my tears and my snot, and my spine got straight. And I said, thank you, Jesus. I just have one. But before she walked out that door, she says, you need a support group. We have a support group in Newark. And I said, no, I don't need a support group. You know, I've never needed any help in my life. I can manage this. But I gave her my card.
They were
and
a
I walked out the
group
door.
Of people.
Those
yes. grandmothers that you were representing, they were a powerful group of people. As a matter of fact, I have that article I found with your friend's picture in it. You know, the lady that, you know, you're very, very close to?
Yes. You know what we did? We stepped out of that door. I went to a support group, and I told Edwina not to let anyone know who I was because I didn't think they'd accept me.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't there as a journalist. I was there as a grandma. And the only comfort I would get emotionally was the 2 days a month that I would spend with them.
Yeah.
But they were busy trying to get a law passed. They were trying to get the kinship care bill passed. And Edwina said to me, we need your help. I said, oh, I'm just too emotional right now. I can't. She said, B, you better buck up. And from that moment on, I began to fight for the kinship care bill. It
right.
just so happens that the acting governor was Donald DeFrancesco,
right.
who lives right here in Scotch Plains.
Oh, does
and who I knew.
Yeah.
And we would get on those buses, boy, and go to Trenton, and then we even went to Capitol Hill.
Grandmother.
And lo and behold, we got the kinship care bill passed in the state of New Jersey. Those grandmas from Newark.
Thank you.
So So the state of New Jersey owes them something. The grandmas and the kin, the families that raise family members. Because we're only one of six states in the nation that have such a bill.
Anna,
yes.
Hold on. Eric, hold on. We're going to go for a break, and we'll be right back, everyone. Stay with us. I'm Kay Thompson. This is Kay and Gusto, producer of Political Roundtables. Eric Payne, he is on, and our guest today is Anison Phillips, producer, writer, grandmother. You're hearing about how what she had to do with and cause the people to look at the kids who were arrested for the Central Park rape case. She also talked and got a confession from the man who actually did the crime. And you're hearing a little bit about the Tawana Rowley case, and there's lots more to come. Stay with us, everyone. We'll be right back. Show. Eric Payne is still on the air, and so is Anna Phillips. And I was expecting Wilfredo Benitez to join us. We know that Wayne Gilman couldn't. And so we're going to be doing a part two of the Central Park rape case of years ago. We're going to be having, by the way, the music that we just heard was, I think this is Fred Ho, The Damn Don't Cry. Wow, I tell you. Is that what this is, Ty? Yes. Okay. Right, I hear that. But anyway, Anna, this is absolutely fascinating, and we're going to have to do this again and again. Okay.
I have a question, Anna. Yes. Have you written a book about this experience?
Which one? The grandma.
Not the grandma's. The Central Park case.
No, because I haven't.
It's a
because
great story,
I had so little
sure
to do with the
movie.
Actual case.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, I had so little to do with the actual case. Mm-hmm. I had more to do with, I actually went to Puerto Rico and met with Mateus Reyes' family, his father, and went up to where he lived, where he grew up, before his father sent him to be with his mother. You know, just to see what kind of kid he was.
Yeah.
And he had a miserable existence. You know, he slept in the truck with his dad. They didn't really have a place to live. He was the kid of the neighborhood. And he lived in a rainforest, in El Yuque.
El Yuque.
In a rainforest. So they lived by the land.
Mm.
And then finally the dad would send him to his mom, who had both no interest in him, or was unfamiliar with raising a kid, and the kid would show up in the middle of her life when he's about 8 or 9 years old. He didn't have a snowball's chance in hell.
Wow. Well.
And he is now an adult? Is he?
He's in his 30s. I suspect in his 40s as well.
He's
serving a 33-and-a-half-year sentence, and he probably will never get out. But you know what? He's a sociopath as well. He didn't confess to that crime until the statute of limitations expired. He could not be convicted for that crime.
Wow.
So
and he had encountered Corey Wise. They were both in the same jail.
Same jail? Good Lord.
Yes. There was a they had a fight in the prison over a TV show. And Mateus Reyes knew that that kid was serving time for a crime that he knew he committed and not the kid. And he said as he went along, as he developed religion and a conscience and took all the courses, you know, and got the therapy in prison and became a human being. He calls himself a monster. He said, I was a monster. But as time went on, he does what most prisoners do. They grow up in prison and they learn. You know, when they get older, they don't have that kid brain anymore. And with counseling, and they learn how to be human, some of them. And that was the case with him. But there was still something cunning about him, something that the thing that struck me the most is how almost down to the day when the statute of limitations expired, he could not be convicted for that crime.
He
confessed.
Mm-hmm. So he did his research. He knew.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, enough for time to do that. Anna, thank you so much.
What a delight. What a pleasure. Eric, it's always good to hear your voice. I'm always watching out for you. I get excited when I see you.
Thank you.
I get excited whenever I see you.
You've seen all the movies he's been in, huh?
Mm-hmm. And Law and Order and Boston. I think it was Boston Legal in the beginning. And wherever I see him.
Yeah.
Well, this certainly sounds like a story that needs to be made into a movie, your quest to help these kids get out of jail. And I'm sure that there would be a line of actresses that would line up to play you in the film, being that we don't have too many positive, even in today's cinema, we don't have the African-American actresses don't have an opportunity to play a strong character like yourself. Certainly a non-fictional character that, you know, helped to bring justice to some people, some of our people that
it
were
It would be
a
good role for a woman to play. Mm-hmm. You're right. I never think of it in terms of that.
Well, listen, we're 2 minutes until the show ends. Anna, listen, next week, okay?
Okay.
Next week, part two, talking to Anna Sims Phillips. And that was about the Central Park Jack rape case. And we will hear more. And this is exciting. This is intense. And this is real. I'm Kay Thompson. And Anna, thank you. Eric, we'll talk to you later. Okay?
Thank you.
I want to tell people that, you know, of course, we're on every single Wednesday. And we are live. And we like your calls. We are you. And you are us. So you tell us what's going on. And we will certainly put it on the air.
On GoPro Radio Network.
On GoPro Radio Network. They have Disappearing Voices out, by the way. We were doing so many things here. By the way, I'm trying to talk to Anna Sims Phillips about being a broadcaster here on GoPro Radio Network. She has stories to tell that you would not believe. We go back many, many, many years, Eric, as you know, and there's so many stories that are intense. You know, so many other avenues to this story. It's not over. It's not over. There's so much more to tell, so much to learn from you, Anna. Thank you. Thank you so much. Okay?
God bless you, and God bless the listeners.
Okay. We'll see you later. Okay.
Okay.
So we have about a minute until the show ends. Thanks to GoPro Radio Network right here, you know, in Jersey City, Time, Washington, Tachi, and all the other teams. You know, this is a family show and a family network. And you know one thing? We do some darn good things, you know? And if you want us to know what you're doing, for instance, you know, I know about Legal Shield. You have to call me about Legal Shield if you want the best in, attorneys. So you can call me at 201-951-9150, and I will, complete or return your call. That's for Legal Shield, which I've been getting calls about. And we have just about a minute until the show ends, and I'm going to talk up to that time back to Ty Washington. We're going to be doing a lot more shows here on GoPro Radio Network, one of the fast and growing shows. And thank you, everyone, for listening, because we are now the top listening to show here on the network. So I'm Kay Thompson, and you are?
Eric Payne.
Right. We'll join us again next Wednesday, 8 to 9. Bye.
Put me up right, yeah. As a youngin', I was getting into something. Never listened to my mother. Always figured she was fucking grandma. But the really mean we opened up, and so I believe in the escape the streets that hit the dungeon. Wake up in the morning, another day of school. Just because I failed doesn't mean that I'm a fool. She's the teacher, they were preachers, and there's a God.